Welcome to another edition of Green is Good, and we're so honored today to have Maury Zimring on. She's the Director of Corporate Responsibility and Environmental Sustainability for Intercontinental Hospitality Group. And also today with us, a return guest, Michael Oshman, who from the Green Restaurant Association. Welcome to Green is Good.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you both for being here. This is such a unique show. We're so honored to have you both on with us. Maury, before we get into talking about ISG and all the great stuff you're doing there, can you talk a little bit about Maury? Talk about your journey. How did you become to get this role and doing all the great work you're doing at Intercontinental Hotels Group?
Sure. Well, the environment's always been important to me. I always knew I wanted to work in some sort of field connected with environmental sustainability. And when I first started out, that really meant that you were either working in the government sector or in a compliance role or on the nonprofit side. So I started my career working at the U.S. Green Building Council doing LEED certification. Really into the nonprofit side. But when I was there, I realized that a lot of the companies I was working with were really interested in not just their building footprint, but all things environmental sustainability. They were looking at their supply chain. They were looking at, you know, a much broader base of how to talk to their space. And I got really excited about what and if you are on the corporate side and how to leverage economies of scale to have a really major impact on the environment. So I went back to business school and to get some more tools in my tool belt in order to enter the corporate sector, and then started working at Coca-Cola on their environmental sustainability and corporate responsibility initiative, and that led me to this role now with Intercontinental Hotel Group, working with all our properties.
That is great, and Coca-Cola has a very great reputation of sustainability, green, and recycling, and all those other kind of things as well. So you obviously learned at one of the greatest brands on the planet.
Yes, it was exceptional training in this space, so I was very lucky for that experience.
And Michael, for our listeners that didn't have the opportunity to listen to your great show the first time you came on Green is Good, share a little bit about your journey and the great organization that you founded and run right now.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me again. Back in 1990, when the world was very polarized between the business and environmental sustainability, and there wasn't quite a green business movement yet, we really saw a need to come in and create solutions, environmental solutions that were practical and easily implementable within a particular sector. And we saw that the restaurant industry was having such a large impact environmentally. 1/10 of the American economy, largest consumer of electricity in the retail sector. So at the young age of 19, I actually listened to those older people and said, go out and make a change, and created the Green Restaurant Association 23 years ago to create easy solutions, reward the restaurant, create empirical standards, and make it feasible for consumers to eat with their values.
Unbelievable. And we're so honored to have you back on again. And both organizations are doing such important work. And I think our listeners will understand the interrelationship between both as the show goes on. For our listeners out there that want to follow along more than just listening to Maury and Michael as we go here, please do what I'm doing. I've got my iPad open and I'm on both their great websites at the same time. For Intercontinental Hotel Group, it's www.ihgplc.com. And for Michael's group, it's dinegreen.com. So listen, let's kick this off. And Maury, this one's for you. In terms of Intercontinental Hotels and Resorts is now branding and maybe the first to brand their restaurants, certified green restaurants. What does that mean with regards to what Michael's already done over, you know, his career and the greening of restaurants, which seems to be a massive trend right now? What does that mean at Intercontinental Hotel Groups and Resorts?
Great. So for IHG, it's probably helpful to know that we have 9 brands within our portfolio.
Wow.
And Intercontinental Hotels and Resorts is one of those brands.
Okay.
So across all of our brands, we have a program called IHG Green Engage, and it's our holistic sustainability tool. We use it across more than 50% of our properties and growing, and it looks at both data measurement, tracking, management, and reporting for our hotels, but also provides them with green solutions. Over 200 different things that our properties could implement to reduce water, to reduce waste, energy, and so on. And that's where the green restaurant certification came in, as one of those potential solutions that our properties could implement. We realized that the restaurant space on property was a unique space, different from the rest of the hotel. There's a lot of potential energy, water, waste consumption. And so there's a lot of opportunity to do something about that. And so rather than reinvent the wheel, we looked to Michael's Group, and it's a great certification system. It's holistic, just as Green Engage is. So it follows a similar theory and model to our own internal system. So we use their certification as our recommendation for how our hotels can green their restaurant space. A few years ago, rather than just leave it as optional, we made the commitment for the particular Intercontinental Hotel and Resort brand to certify all of their restaurants in the Americas. And that's when we really started partnering with Michael and his team in a really robust way to make sure all of our restaurants were also on a similar sustainability journey to the rest of our hotels.
And how many restaurants are we talking about? Because there, you have so many properties, and as you said, and there's so many different branding opportunities. How many restaurants was this first tranche?
Yep. So now we have 26 different restaurants across the Americas who are certified with the Green Restaurant Certification.
Wow. And Michael, how did talk a little bit about your side of the equation? Because what we're seeing now in around the world, but right here in the United States, are some of the greatest brands partnering together, collaborating to create relevant and important change, and to do a lot of co-branding and co-marketing together around that, the change that they're effectuating. Michael, talk a little bit about your side of the equation, how this relationship started, and why it was important for the work that you do.
Wonderful. Well, about 2 years ago, or 3 years ago or so, we started working with the Boston Hotel, actually, which happens to be walking distance from our office here. A wonderful hotel with some wonderful restaurants, Mail and Rumba, right on the water there. And they kind of piloted this. I think there was already an interest in their food service leadership, and they piloted it. After a year of success of this restaurant becoming certified, at an annual meeting, they had me speak to the GMs of all the hotels of the brand. And very soon after, the leadership brought on, 2 years ago, all of the restaurants, as Maury mentioned. And I have to say this, and I don't say it lightly, making a commitment of that level for an entire brand — we've worked with hotels before, but to have an entire brand make a commitment was unprecedented, especially a brand such as Intercontinental. And that was a first in the hotel arena. What's even more impressive is they got all but one of their hotels. The truth is they got all of their restaurants certified in a year.
Wow.
We have single-unit restaurants. Most restaurants take less than that. But to get 26 restaurants in a hotel brand in a big company certified in a year made our internal team excited. We talked about the Intercontinental as a model of how other clients can work. It ends up that one of their restaurants rebranded, a couple things changed, and therefore we delayed the announcement a little bit. But the reality is, had that not rebranded, the accomplishment would have been in a year. And they did a phenomenal job all the way from the top of their leadership down to to the people implementing it on the ground. And so we announced just recently, just a couple weeks ago, a new announcement that the last dotting of the I's and crossing the T's happened recently, and they are the first hotel chain, not just to commit, but to actually have met the certified green restaurant standards. And they have restaurants at 2-star, they have restaurants at 3-star. They've done a phenomenal job, and you know, I don't say that lightly. They really go down in history of the green restaurant movement as the first hotel that has achieved this goal.
That's awesome. And you know, again, and for our listeners out there that want to follow all the great discussion we're having here with Maury and Michael, please go to www.dinegreen.com and www.ihgplc.com. Maury, I'm on your website now, and it is, and I hit the corporate responsibility button, and it is just amazing what you're doing with regards to environmental sustainability, your Green Engage video. I mean, this is really exciting stuff. But, you know, I'm an outsider. When you started this program with Michael and the greening of these restaurants in the Americas, how was it received by your employees and by your staff? And how did you get engagement from within to start with?
We've been incredibly lucky because we have such amazing teams in the field and on property. IHG Green Engage, our internal program, launched in 2009, and it's a voluntary program. We don't, at the moment, require that our hotels participate. And on their own, we have over 50% of the estate who have joined on the sustainability journey, who participate in that program. So they really understand that this is part of how we do business. It drives our employee engagement scores, which is incredibly important when you have really tough jobs on property and high turnover rates. And this has, you know, we've seen great results as a in response to all of our corporate responsibility initiatives. Our properties understand that it reduces their costs. Energy costs are typically the number two line item for a hotel. So they understand the business value and that our customers really care about this. So I think because it's been such an integral part of how we make decisions as a business and how we go to market, we had great enthusiasm for teaming up with Michael's group and taking this a step further to really look at the restaurant space. Every food and beverage director that I spoke with about this program was really excited about the opportunity to share sustainability with their specific food and beverage teams and highlight all of the things that they could do together working with Michael's group.
With 26, that's a fascinating number. From the standpoint where do you get to both have them, all your managers and your leadership team across those 26 share best practices as this got implemented, but also compete with one another to get it done better, faster, more efficiently, and to succeed more? How does that work when you're trying to build the kumbaya feeling and teamwork, but you're also potentially, appealing to everybody's love of competition? How did that work?
Well, certainly a little healthy competition never hurts. we have a great community, and the hotels speak to each other quite regularly. They share best practices. They connect with each other. So it's a really happy camaraderie that they're able to share. And Michael, I don't know if you have other perspectives from having worked with them.
Yeah, I think that there's a couple things that worked well for Intercontinental. One is the fact that Boston had already had such success.
Yeah.
There was leadership within the Boston hotel that the other managers could go to. So they didn't have to just rely on my presentation. They could go to somebody on the inside and say, is that right? Did you really save money? Are employees really excited about this? And they got to hear it from somebody who is one of their colleagues, not me. So I'd say that was one piece of success. And there's also, which I attribute to, we always love to bring on as many restaurants on board as possible, but there are definitely many times where it's great to start with a few and leverage that success to the rest of a brand. And I think that InterContinental did that in a very smart way. There's also a second piece that just must have to do with an internal culture at the hotel, because even before we signed an agreement and there was just talk and it looked like things were happening, we had such excitement from these hotels. I remember getting a contact directly from somebody in one of the New York properties saying, okay, great, we've got our documents ready. We're ready to go. We want to be. And they were so jazzed. And we had to actually say that to this gentleman, wonderful, just hold off a week. We're finalizing the details. We'll create a strategy. And that is the opposite of the problem we normally have. The normal challenge is getting restaurants to submit the documentation. They do it, but they're so busy that it ends up taking what normally could take a couple days, could take a few weeks. And with InterContinental, you know, a commitment is something, but there's a very big difference between implementing something in a year or two versus 10. And right, they not only got these incredible numbers, I can give you these details. I mean, yeah, in total, the 26 certified green restaurants implemented 1,180 environmental steps over those 26 properties, wow, earning them 3,341 green points. Pretty impressive.
Unreal. You know, so for both of you, so you know, this is a question for both of you. Michael, is this a new paradigm for your great organization that will now be replicated at other great hotel and hospitality brands? And Maury, for you, is this now the beginning of a paradigm within your great brand that is now going to be spreading to some of your other restaurants within your other hotel properties? And you take it one at a time. Michael, why don't you go first and then Maury?
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. You know, what we found is there's so many different sectors. There's the education sector, there's hotels, there's fast food,
yeah,
there's fine dining, there's celebrity chefs, there's sports stadiums. And in the university sector, we definitely find that certain leaders have come on board, and now we've got Harvard and Boston University, Northeastern and UCLA, and some of the preeminent educational institutions. But it always starts with one, and then other people look to that one. We just got, I can't tell you who it is yet, but we just got a huge, huge, huge sports event and sports stadium that hopefully we'll be announcing in the next couple months, and that will likely leverage to other sports stadiums. And I would say, you know, based upon our history, people will look to the InterContinental Hotels and Resorts and answer the question that is the biggest one that prevents people to act, which is, does this really make business sense? Right. And when people see Mario Batali doing this, the other chefs follow. When people see InterContinental Hotels and Resorts doing this, they say, gosh, that is a highly successful brand. They know what they're doing. And if they did this, then maybe our brand can do it too. So based upon precedent, I would say it's very likely that that InterContinental will see the leadership of their steps not only leverage internally, but actually having a wonderful impact in the industry as a whole.
Maury, and how about for you? Do you see this as a shining light inside your brand and other restaurants within your other great properties are now going to take up this mantle and run with it as well?
Absolutely. I would expect for this to continue to grow for us. You know, we've learned so much, and Michael was spot on. When we have properties that can reach out to one another to find out, how did this really work for you? What was the impact? What were the savings? It really changes the comfort, the ease of entry, the ability for our properties to feel like this is something that they too can go after. So I think now that we've had such success with the InterContinental Hotels and Resorts brand, it's quite likely that other properties will start to catch on and will want to follow suit. You know, we love to lead in this space. So the more best practice and case study that we can share so others can join in, the better.
You know, let's talk. Let's just go back. And for our listeners out there, you know, I want them to understand in terms of the environment what really was accomplished, so they can understand in these 26 restaurants what are some of the understandable terms and vernacular that the general public who enjoys your restaurants, what was accomplished during this whole greening process?
Well, you know, I think there's a couple key things for us. It's a great way to look at the restaurant holistically.
Mm-hmm.
So we're able to look at waste reduction, both in terms of, you know, how much product the restaurant is bringing in so that they're doing appropriate ordering, and then how they're managing the waste leaving the property, recycling, composting, really finding different solutions so that we're not sending waste to landfill unnecessarily. There's energy conservation measures, water conservation measures, so local and organic sourcing. So I think the great thing about this certification is that there's a lot of opportunities to find reductions, but there's also flexibility. So each restaurant is able to meet some base requirements and then find the right path and achieve the appropriate points to achieve certification, but in a way that makes sense for them. And that flexibility and that ability to be on a sustainable journey that has some customization is really important for the different restaurants, the different profiles, the different locations.
You know, Maury, it's so fascinating because you are part of such a large organization. And, you know, I'm on your website right now, and it's just a great website. Again, for our listeners out there, it's www.ihgplc.com. And there's so many areas, as you say, from biodiversity to waste to water to energy to climate and carbon. Does this this leadership role that you've taken and this step off to greening these 26 restaurants also, is it looked upon from the hoteliers with inside your organization? And does this bleed over to inspiring the folks who run the room side of your business to further green their rooms and do more inside of the hotel part of your business?
Absolutely, it does. And that's something we're so excited about, that the room side of our business and the food and beverage side of our business can have complementary goals and achievements. And on the room side, we've really been focusing on our program that I mentioned, IHG Green Engage. And it's similar in that it looks at waste and water and carbon and really takes a holistic approach to environmental sustainability. And there, our properties have also been on a similar journey, picking and choosing the right solutions that make sense for them. So we've seen, you know, everything from properties with rooftop gardens to solar to properties that are really doing best practices behind the scenes and finding great energy and water conservation measures. So in that space, we've actually just a few weeks ago launched new targets for our entire estate. So by 2017, we plan to reduce our carbon per occupied room by 12% and our water use in water-stressed areas by 12%. So we're excited that we've now completed the Green Restaurant Certification, but also launched new targets for the hotel side of our operations to really strive for more reductions and more success.
Michael, you know, for you, the business opportunity here, if I'm a guy that sits in a position similar to Maury's at another great brand, or if I'm a guy who owns a franchise of a smaller hotel or motel chain, but of course I have food in that chain, is it smarter now for me to call Michael Oshman and partner with your great organization to green my beverage and dining experience than go do this on my own? Is that just better practice now to collaborate with your great organization because of the experience you have at this?
I'd love to answer the question, but do you mind if I say something about the environmental details of the Intercontinental's accomplishments?
No, absolutely. No, that's okay. Why we're here today.
Great, great. So just from the question a few minutes ago, kind of the details, I'm pulling up, your listeners should know that every single restaurant of the Intercontinental and every one of the certified restaurant has on the web, free and accessible to any consumer, to see exactly what they're doing. So they can, I just went on to the Barclay Bar and Grill, a property, Intercontinental property in New York, just to see what they were doing so I could share it with you.
Yeah.
And it's accessible to you also. They're a 3-star restaurant with 237 points. And just to give the listeners an idea of what they're doing for their, you know, 60 or 70 points that they're implementing, over 80% of their lighting is LED, which is the most efficient, non-toxic lighting out there these days. They've got pre-rinse spray valves that clean the pots and the pans in the back that are less than 1 gallon, which exceeds the legal limit. 1.6 is the max. They're way, way, way under that. It's a super efficient one. They've got touchless sensor faucets. They have a one neat statistic in water where they serve water upon request, which seems like a very simple thing until you listen to the following statistic. Serving water only upon request provides an amazing method for conserving water, working to reduce the 410 billion gallons of ground and surface water withdrawn by the U.S. every day. In the U.S., an estimated 70 million meals are served in the restaurant each day. And if one quarter of the customers declined water service, 26 million gallons of fresh water would be saved every day. That is a basic thing that every consumer, every restaurant can do.
Wow.
And you see the statistics are phenomenal. And you and we all know that not everybody drinks their water when they go to a restaurant. It's a great opportunity also to save energy, to save chemicals.
True.
So some of them are high-tech solutions like LED, or this restaurant is actually growing some of the food right on the premises. And some of them are just common sense that every single restaurant can do today. So I encourage the listeners to look at all the other steps that they're doing, from the menu paper they're using, to the non-toxic candles, to the zero VOC paints, et cetera.
To answer
your question, is it smarter to go it alone, or is it smarter to kind of leverage what's already been done? I gave a speech a few years back to a distributor conference called the Wild West of Green. we're still a little bit in the Wild West, meaning if you go it alone, you could hit the jackpot. You also could make a big mistake. For example, you could go after a cleaner that has lots of great green marketing, but if you look at the details of it, unless you're a chemist or unless it's got a certification that's trustworthy, you might end up with an awful chemical with really great packaging. Same thing with a takeout package. There are brown takeout packaging that I've seen in distributors' guides labeled as green, and I've had to tell them that particular packaging is actually bleached and virgin, and they actually dyed it. They dyed it brown to make it look green.
Wow.
And this distributor was communicating that message unintentionally. They didn't know.
Right.
So you could really end up in the Wild West of, even on the lighting side right now, you can go after something that isn't wrong, but there's a better solution. You know, instead of saving 30%, you could save 70%. Instead of getting a bulb that lasts X, you can get a bulb that lasts, you know, five times as long with warranties. And unless you do this every day, you can miss that opportunity. If you're in New Jersey and you don't know about the direct install program, you might not know that you can get 70% off of lighting and spray valves and all these things directly right off the bat. And if you're a restaurateur, you might not know that. So it's important, it's generally leveraging success ends up saving the restaurant's time, is going to help them save the most amount of money, and most importantly, is going to get them the products and services they're actually after. We don't care what napkin the restaurant uses, if they use this brand's 90% post-consumer napkin or that, and so we're able to kind of advocate based upon the mission and not what a distributor or somebody in particular is selling. And the last piece is, there's only one way to communicate to the public what a business is doing. If a business says, "Hey, I'm doing this in my restaurant," that's nice, but you're no different than the guy across the street who's saying the same thing who might not be as trustworthy. And so it's hard to distinguish. And so it's really important in this day and age of greenwashing, when a claim is made for the Intercontinental Hotels and Resorts, the consumers can get more detail than most consumers want, which is not only what level of certification, how many points, how many steps, and what are all the steps that they're doing, and they know that the restaurants are being recertified each year. And that creates an incredible sense of confidence and brand awareness that this is not only legit, this is transparent down to the core, and that really inspires people. So yeah, I would say, you know, whether it's in the restaurant industry or whether it's people doing something in other fields, in the environmental world, we're still in a place where it makes sense to leverage experience, knowledge, gotcha, and transparency.
And Maury, you were down to the last 2 minutes or so. Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners out there who want to join in all the great work that you're doing at Intercontinental Hotels and what Michael's doing? Share some of your last thoughts as well.
Yeah, I mean, for us, I think Michael really hit it when talking about transparency, because it's all about really being able to share the story, share the ups and downs, the obstacles and the success. And for us, that's all about meeting our customer needs, letting our customers know exactly what we've been doing, all the details behind the scenes that we're taking care of for them in terms of sustainability, and then hearing from them about what's important to them in terms of sustainability at the hotel level. So I think we will continue to share our story so that our customers know that they can stay with us confidently. And what we hope for those that are listening and interested is that they continue to share with us what's important to them about this space, so that we can continue to meet their needs and further explore how to have even more sustainable hotels at IHG.
Perfect. And for our listeners out there that want to learn more about Maury and Michael's great organizations, please go to ihgplc.com or dyinggreen.com. Maury Zimring and Michael Oshman, you're both inspiring and visionary sustainability superstars and truly living proof that green is good. Welcome back to Green is Good, and we're going to Detroit, USA right now. We're bringing on Carrie Majeski from the great and worldwide iconic brand Ford. Welcome to Green is Good, Carrie.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. You're the manager of sustainable and safety engineering, Carrie. How did you ever become the manager of sustainable and safety engineering at this amazing brand Ford? Tell us a little bit about the journey. Did you grow up from a little girl dreaming to become a sustainability and safety engineering manager?
I wish I could say that I did. I don't think I could have plotted this path if I had to.
Okay.
But and I'm very old, so I told you this is a pretty long story. I'll
let me hear it. I want to hear it, and I want our listeners to hear it, because there's so many other young ladies across the world that listen to this show, and truly, this is about inspiration and education, so I want them to hear your journey.
Great. Well, I started as an engineering student. I graduated from the University of Michigan in 1984. That'll give you an idea of my age. And at that point, I honestly know if we had defined the term sustainability. And I came into the company knowing that I wasn't going to necessarily do nuts and bolts engineering forever, but I knew I needed that experience. So I went into suspension design. I did my early engineering work in truck product development, working on suspensions for trucks. And that sort of segued into, I went from very specific to pretty much more general as I went over time. So I moved into more program management, business strategy, regulatory plans. At one point, I had a really cool job. It was the Women's Marketing and Product Office, where we were trying to figure out tools and processes for people to think about the vehicle from a woman's perspective. You know, can you get in and out of a car without chipping your nails? Can you get in and out of a truck with a tighter skirt on, ingress, egress? And we, you know, we're basically trying to help the product development engineers design our vehicles so that women would want to buy them, because we knew at that point, and we still know, that women influence about 80% of the vehicle purchase.
Wow.
So anyway, that was a really cool job. I also spent some time in battery electric vehicle as a chief engineer, and that was in the 90s when it wasn't quite ready, 80s and 90s, and a little bit of work in fuel cell engineering and those programs. And then the segue into this position was from a planning job where I was looking at future fuel economy, safety, and emissions regulations, and making sure that our incoming products had met all the phase-ins and all the very complex regulations, so getting the right content into future programs. And from there, I started working on what's now our global CO2 glide path that's aligned with stabilization at 450 ppm in the atmosphere, which is what we think is, climate scientists think is a reasonable level of CO2 in the atmosphere to mitigate climate change. And it was with that work, I was working with a group of people much smarter than I, who had powertrain experience and fuels experience and modeling tools, and we came up with our what's now our blueprint for sustainability. And that's when my boss said, okay, now you've been in the product development world, we're trying to take sustainability to the next level, and we want to integrate it into the rest of the company. It's going from being a public affairs thing and a reputational thing to driving the business. So
wow.
Asked me to join this team, and I have been working on product sustainability initiatives ever since.
That is awesome. And that was back around 2007 where that all happened?
Yeah, that was a really kind of a critical turning point for the company, and I was happy to be maintained as a part of it. So we've come a long way from there, and you know, at that point, not only did our product portfolio take hold, but the business piece was given the right attention too, and that's I think why I'm here to talk to you today. Is we've kind of hit our stride, and going well.
Yeah, and for our listeners out there that want to follow along more than just listening to Carrie and what she's doing over at Ford, you can go to two great websites. First, you can go to the core website, www.ford.com, but of course, on this issue, and to learn more about sustainability and the sustainability journey that Ford is on, you go to media.ford.com, media.ford.com, and there's a great section on innovation and sustainability and all the great things that Carrie and her team are doing at the wonderful brand Ford. Carrie, let's get into it a little bit now. And I'm on the website, so I have the fun of being on the website and talking with you at the same time. Talk a little bit about one of your most iconic brands, the Ford F-150, and what's going on innovative right now with the F-150 that you want to share with our listeners out there.
The F-150 has been a great product for many years, hundreds of thousands of vehicles a year we sell. And what we're talking about today is just one small innovation that can have a much bigger difference in the long run, which is just, it's a wiring harness bracket that's rice hull instead of petroleum in the plastic. So we've taken something that was 100% petroleum-based and now infused a renewable resource that displaces some of that petroleum. And so 10% of the material is rice hull, 25% is recycled polypropylene, and 65% is still virgin polypropylene. But what this does, you know, when we do these kinds of things, is just sort of pilot a new material, something that's grown, not a scarce natural resource. Sometimes it can be cost effective. Sometimes it can be just, we wouldn't do it if it wasn't cost parity with the outgoing
right.
material. Sometimes these kinds of materials can offer weight saves. So it's small part, little bit of renewable material, but when you multiply that by hundreds of thousands of vehicles, it makes a difference.
It does. But you know, when we start thinking about, now I had never heard of that part before you ever brought that up. And, you know, but how many, you know, when you talk about little steps that, you know, on a journey that then, you know, little steps in the right direction that lead up to big changes. How many parts go into a car, and how do you deconstruct a car from where you stand as the manager of sustainability and safety engineering, and then decide which parts you think you have opportunities to change, like you've changed this part?
Well, it's, I mean, kind of bottom up, top down.
Yeah.
We don't say I want to change that wiring harness bracket. You know, it's kind of, we've pretty much, from a sustainable material side, we set aside the metals. That, you know, metals are recyclable. We need them. You know, we're lightweighting with different metals. But we set aside the metals. We look mostly at the plastics and the non-metallic stuff. And then our wonderful partners in the supply base are also important to this journey. They are the ones that bring these initiatives forward. They've done, by the time they bring them to us, they've done some of the early screening work, and then we find the right application with our research folks, do the diligence in terms of development, because we're not going to do anything that compromises the performance of these products. And then once we know we have a product that performs in a business case, we go forward, and generally, if it's something a little bit more innovative, we'll start small and then migrate over time to more applications as we know we've got a good deal all the way around.
So on the metal side, traditionally, what metals go into a car? Because I'm a layman, I really don't know this thing. I just know my car key starts a car and I go. I mean, but help me with what metals are traditionally the metals, and how you evolve that to be lighter and stronger and create a more sustainable car.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's basically steel, cast iron, high-strength steel, aluminum, as we get more aggressive with weight, some magnesium. So a lot of different kinds of metals. And we do, you know, we're focusing, we have big weight challenges because weight is really how you get to fuel efficiency, and fuel efficiency is really the biggest environmental impact we can make. So that's our number one priority. Where lightweighting is concerned, we've done some things that are really innovative in terms of downsizing and boosting our engines. So you lightweight the vehicle so you can use a smaller engine, so you can lightweight other parts of the vehicle. So there's sort of an iterative impact there. And with the metals, we are obviously looking from a system and figuring out where can we use high-strength steel, aluminum, more strategically to take big chunks of weight out of the vehicle that'll then allow us to use smaller engines and get better fuel economy.
And for our listeners who just joined us, we've got Carrie Majeski on. She's the Manager of Sustainable and Safety Engineering at the great brand Ford. And to follow along online like I am, you could go to media.ford.com. Carrie, what other environmental friendly materials are you developing and going to be featuring in your Ford cars and trucks now and in the future that will make your vehicles more sustainable?
Well, one of our biggest successes, a lot of people aren't aware of, is soy-based seat foams. We were approached by the soybean board, which had an excess of soy, and they came to our research team and they said, we really want to do something with soy. They found a way to displace, again, petroleum in our seat foams, and it took a lot of development, a lot of iterations, a lot of work to get it to perform right, to not have any odor, to not degrade over time. And they have now, we now have about 10% soy-based foams in all of our cars and trucks we produce in North America. We also have about 75% of our headrests have the same soy foam. And then we've got a headliner, which is the sort of the inside of the roof material that also on our Ford Escape is featuring the soy foam. So right now from that, the applications of soy foam, we're diverting about 5 million pounds of petroleum a year from the application of that foam, and that reduces CO2 emissions by about 20 million pounds annually. So, you know, tailpipe emissions improving fuel economy reduces tailpipe emissions in the use space of our vehicles, but this is a way we can also have an impact on CO2 emissions in the materials phase of the life cycle.
How long did it take for you to develop that? And then after you've proven success, and this year you're at 5 million pounds displacement, does that grow over time in terms of the use of the product after you find success?
Yeah, well, I think the plan is to continue to see how much more soy we can use, and so we'll go from 10% to maybe 15, 20%, 25%.
Right.
I don't know how far they'll be able to push that limit. But, yeah,
right.
the idea is now that we've migrated it all across the product lines and gotten all the volume we can, then, you know, go higher in terms of percent of the foam.
Right, right,
so
right.
Possibilities, you know, nothing...
How long does that take? How long does that whole R&D...
right now to announce along those
yeah.
lines. But, you know, the other thing, there's more materials. We're also experimenting with things like wheat straw we've used
yeah.
as a plastics reinforcement in a cargo bin in a rear of the Flex vehicle. And that one, good news, it was a good application, performed well, couldn't get quite to the cost that we needed, so that one didn't go forward. So we're not going to just go ahead and do this
right.
volume if it's really not a good total business case.
Right, right, right.
We're also using cellulose, which is sort of wood pulp, as a plastics reinforcer that's about to be in more of our products. Coconut, there's a couple different applications of coconut, sort of grounding up the shell and using that as a plastics reinforce is one way. The coir, or the sort of hairy stuff on the outside of the coconut, for lack of a better word, has been used in a trunk liner application, like behind the carpet. So a lot of these things aren't visible because customers wouldn't necessarily like the way they looked. They're
right.
behind the scenes right now. But there's a lot of things in there. And then there's some... other applications that we're just kind of toying with right now. There's some sustainable rubber from dandelions that's potentially could be introduced
yeah.
if we get to the point where it's ready. We a fun one. We're doing a lot of different recycled content too. I've been
right.
talking about the renewables or the things you grow, but we also have a recycled application where they take retired U.S. currency, so you get chunks, of, you know, stacks of dollar bills or $100 bills, and otherwise they would be incinerated or put into a landfill, which none of those are good options. But linen has really good material properties, so as a reinforcement in plastic, it has a potential. And they're looking at it as a first application for a coin tray, which would be kind
Come
of
on.
A cute.
That is amazing. So wait a second now. I want to step back here. This is one of the greatest brands in the world, Ford is, that you get to work with. And so, you know, as opposed to some of the coolest brands that were developed in America of recent times or in the United States out of Silicon Valley, like an Apple iPhone, you're really doing, though, some very cool things and on an industrial level behind the scenes there. And like you said, some of them are very not, very invisible. How does the, explain to our audience the cool things you're doing that many of them never get to see, both in finished product or even in process. But how does that work? How do you inspire both innovation at Ford internally, but also externally with your vendors?
Well, the internal answer, there's a very talented team of research scientists in our labs whose just their whole mission in life is to take stuff that would otherwise be wasted or grown
yeah.
and find applications that make sense in our products. That's what they do, and they love it, and they're very good at it. They're very, bright engineers and researchers, but they also have an eye to the sustainability piece of
right.
it. And as far as the supply base goes, everybody's looking for an edge and a hook. It's competitive industry, competitive to be in our supply chain, and we need innovators. And so two suppliers come to us with the same part. One has renewable content, the other doesn't, and they're the, same performance, same cost. You got an edge if you're the guy who brings us an innovative part. And they want to do good, too. I think people want to do good. That's what we're finding within Ford is I know the practitioners all over the company who are just out there doing their otherwise mundane jobs, but also trying to do them to make the world a better place. And that's makes it exciting, and it gives us some of the innovations that have just happened.
Yeah.
With obviously the support of the bigger company structure around it. So,
and I'm on your site, and I'm looking at this beautiful rectangle with one of your vehicles in it, and it's Blueprint for Sustainability 2012 and 13. And around this vehicle, you have a lot of different arrows, and it goes to vehicle safety, supply chain, people, water, climate change, and financial health. Why don't you do an overview, if you can, Carrie, and it's on some of your favorite topics as to what is Ford doing in some of these other areas, because sustainability truly is holistic, and it's a journey. It's not an all or nothing, and it's not a kill shot. We all know that. So if you could just share some of the sustainability journey on some of those other topics, it would be wonderful for our listeners to hear the inspirational things you're doing there in those areas.
Okay. Well, and I'm looking at the same page. So this is the electronic, if you will, cover of our latest sustainability report. And I will do a plug. This is the 14th report that we've issued. The first ones were much different, very, you know, get our toe in the water. But we've, over time, really done a better and better job of being transparent about what we're doing and how we're doing it and where our challenges are and where our successes are, and having some measurable, you know, accountability for what we're doing. So this is, you know, this is the summary. It starts, the reporting process starts with a materiality assessment, which basically says, you know, what's the most important and what's the biggest challenge, and we need to be working on the most important things that are our biggest challenges. Biggest challenges that don't have any impact, okay, that'll take care of itself. But so that's what ends up in the report. And climate change and the environment is probably the biggest one here. But everything on this page represents one of the materiality issues for us. So just to give you the highlights, the climate change I mentioned, we have a glide path around 450 ppm, which is the climate scientists' accepted level of concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere to limit the rise in temperature to 2 degrees. We have so that glide path is our fleet average CO2 emissions out of the tailpipe that we need to hit over the long haul. This number will go out to the year 2200 if we're all around that long.
Right.
And we know kind of where we need to be, and we are regularly calibrating our product plans to know that we have our fleet average declining at the rate that needs to contribute to that climate strategy. Now, that's our product. Obviously, we have operations that have energy and CO2 emissions. We also are working on substantial improvements in the emissions in our facilities and our operations, which, oh, by the way, generally when you reduce energy, that's also a good business case. So a lot of the things we're doing tie into the business and the environment.
Right.
Moving around the circle here, financial health is clear. If we're not in business to do any good, we won't do any good.
Right.
We have to look at our overall financial health and profitability, and we do report on that, and I won't go into the details.
Right.
You can find them all over the web.
Right.
Vehicle safety is something we will never compromise. We're always pushing forward on not just meeting the regulations, but looking at the customer safety features, things like inflatable rear seat belts that, you know, were a recent innovation that are, you know, nobody mandated that. It's just another way to keep someone safe. Supply chain, we clearly can have impact in our own space, but by virtue of the massive supply chain that we work with, we are trying to share the learnings on human rights, on energy and environment with our supply chain, so that not only are we doing good things, but we are helping them to have the same standards and the same practices, and we're learning from them and they're learning from us, and we work very carefully with our supply chain to do that. People is obviously where this all starts. And so we do have some reporting on who our people are and where they are and what we're up to, and I think we've got a pretty happy workforce. Probably there's always room to improve there, and I think you'll probably see some more diligence in reporting on the people side over time in the report. And then water is not new, but clearly the water scarcity and water quality are becoming more and more at the forefront. You know, people around here say, yeah, we've been worrying about climate change, but that'll take hundreds of years to get to us. Water won't take that long if we really aren't careful with it. So we're embarking on a corporate global water strategy that starts to look at how do we reduce water usage in our facilities, and how do we consider it when we do things like alternative fuels, and even in the manufacturing, what are we doing about water quality and water scarcity in the places where we operate. So those are the highlights of what we talk about in the report. Like I said, you can mill around that report online forever and not read everything. It's more than 500 pages of information, and we use this as our inventory within the company as well. Yeah. So it's our, how do we communicate all the good stuff with our employees so we can be the ambassadors for the company too.
You know, but you know, like you said, when it comes to water, just as a highlight, I was just reading another fact online. You know, you cut global water use 8.5% per vehicle. That's that adds up.
It does.
You know,
yeah,
you know,
when you're building millions of vehicles a year.
You know, so
it can be a lot of water.
You know, that adds up. You know, we're down to the last couple of minutes or so, and I want to sort of switch topics, Carrie. Of course, Ford is doing amazing things, but I want to also talk about leadership. And leadership as, you know, you and I are of the same generation. And when we were graduating college, it was a much different world, as we know, not only with regards to sustainability, but for also leadership opportunities. And here you are in 2013, a leader of a very important issue at a very big and important brand. When Ford moves, when Ford makes a move in sustainability, the needle truly moves. And here you are as a manager of sustainable and safety engineering. And recently, we see this whole movement led by some of the more, you know, some of the new leaders in on the West Coast of the dot-com era, the Sheryl Sandbergs of the world and those folks, of this whole lean in and women leadership. In the last couple minutes, can you share some thoughts? Because we have young people in the United States and actually around the world, because after we air on Sirius, we actually are uploaded on the iTunes network, and we track our thousands and thousands of downloads around the world. There's a lot of young women out there that want to become the next Carrie Majeski. Can you? No, seriously, you know, I'm being
That's scary.
No, but I mean, what's the, what? You know, you broke through before it was okay or cool to break through. What pearls of wisdom can you now share backwards with the next generation on how to be a leader and how to effectuate change in whatever they want to do?
Wow, I you know, I don't think I'm a very simple person. I don't consider myself overly bright, but I'm bright, but I like to keep things simple. I mean, I came into the company, as I mentioned, and I got a good solid academic background. I didn't mention it, but I have an MBA out of the University of Michigan as well. So education is important. You don't have to know coming out of the chute what you want to do. I think I have kind of let it happen, and I've never managed my career. I've always tried to do my job, and wherever the job I was, I've tried to understand how it fits into the bigger picture and maybe where it would take me. But you know, like I said, you do your job. I've always wanted to do things that I felt were important. I've always wanted to work for people that had integrity and cared about people. So I think, I keep it very simple. Do what you like to do. Ultimately, I believe everybody will do what they like to do. Doesn't matter where they are. They're going to do what they like to do. Find that place. Get a good education. Take care of the people around you, the people that work for you, the people that you work for, and you know, set your sights on just taking the next step. You don't have to fix everything today. Just, you know, take the next step in the right direction. You know, as far as sustainability goes, I'm just joining the Herb Advisory Board, and the Herb is a program at the University of Michigan between the School of Natural Resources and the business school, Ross Business School. And that program is just amazing, and it's attracting people who have already done way more in their lives than I ever will. And they're young people who now want the education around it. So there are some really cool programs like that in sustainability that can kickstart you. But frankly, I'm not sure we know yet how we're going to harness those people within a corporate framework as they come into our space. And we do have some students coming in that are just amazing, and they have the better education than I had and a head start. But they also then have to be grounded in the business. You know, if you work for a company or even a nonprofit, know your business and do the right thing.
Awesome. And thank you for your time today, Carrie Majeski. You are just, really wonderful. And thanks for spending time with us. For our listeners out there, go to media.ford.com. Carrie Majeski, you're an inspiring sustainability leader and truly living proof that green is good.
Thank you so much.